It went straight down the middle. Then it started to hook.
Welcome to another edition of For the Good of the Game. And Bruce Devlin, I was going to do this opener in Spanish, and then I realized two things. One, I don't speak it that well. And two, I'm not sure our guest would understand me anyway, but he was supposed to be one of our first guests over a year ago when we first got started. And I'll tell you this, with all due respect to your ball striking, Bruce, this guy could make his ball talk in different languages.
Well, isn't that the truth? Not only that, but he is the only professional golfer that has ever put me to bed.
Many times.
And I want to tell you what a great thrill it is to have Lee Trevino with us this morning. One of the truly great. And look, people talk about the great ball strikers that have ever played this game, and two names come up all the time: Ben Hogan and Lee Trevino. And I can assure you, I've played with both of them, and those two evaluations are correct. Lee, thanks for being with us, buddy.
Thank you. Thanks, Bruce. Hey, Mike, how are you? Good to see you guys. Yeah, we've been trying to do this thing for quite a while. Great compliment telling me that I was a ball striker, and so was Hogan. You know, they ask me that question all the time, and I never call myself a great ball striker. I was kind of a scrambler. I could do what I wanted to do with a golf ball. But you can't leave Sam Snead out of there, you know. This Sam Snead was pretty good. I mean, this guy was fantastic when he came there. But you know, you're going back talking about putting you to bed and stuff. We had some great times. I think one of the first times I ever saw you, and I don't know if you remember this or not, but I went to Sydney, and we were having a tournament at Yarra Yarra in Melbourne. And I went and stopped and seen Sandy, and he was making those irons. You remember the Australian blade?
Schlesinger's, yeah. Schlesinger's.
Yes, and he made me this set of irons. And he delivered them on Wednesday when we played the Pro-Am at Yarra Yarra. And you and I, if I'm not mistaken, tied, and you beat me in the playoff, or you beat me by one shot in the tournament. I remember that. Yeah, I remember it. I use those clubs.
Playoff. Beat you in the playoff at the 17th
hole. That's what it was, yes. I thought it was a playoff. And, you know, and I used those clubs. I used those clubs for so many years. I won some major championships for those clubs. Yeah, that was one of the greatest irons I had ever seen. Then he was one fabulous club maker. This guy, yeah.
Yes, he was. He was.
Yeah.
So while we're on the subject, let's hear about this incident, because Lee Gloria was the one that told me this story about at some point you putting him to bed.
Yeah,
I don't remember all the details.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. I was sober enough where I didn't get in there with him. So we absolutely enjoyed life. It was different back then. Not a lot of the wives traveled, as you well know, when we played. We had families, and the wives stayed home with the kids going to school and what have you. We liked a pint here and there. We had a few here and there, and sometimes we had a few too many, and this is what happened to us, yeah.
Well, that was a victory evening, if you remember. That's when I won the what would be now called the World Golf Championship I believe it was Birkdale.
Yeah.
Anyhow.
It was Birkdale. Yeah. And we stayed at the Prince of Wales, you remember? And we used to go to Kingsway Casino across the street. That's where we got smashed, over there in that casino.
Well, you talk about the wives traveling, and reminds me of a story Bruce told me. I think it involved you two guys, and it was back when he might have invited you to come over and play the Open at Royal Sydney. And I think your wife was with you at the time, and they wouldn't let you guys in the clubhouse to access the bathrooms.
Well, a lot of people don't really realize how golf evolved back in the old days. If you went to Britain, and back in the 30s, they wouldn't let you in the clubhouse then. The golf professional was not a member of the club, so he stayed. He was not allowed in the clubhouse, even the golf professional that was there. So when you had a tournament, you brought the PGA in, they actually put a tent up outside. 1972, we went to Royal Sydney and played, and the accommodations were great. I mean, they had a tent out there. Great food, great drink, everything else, but we were not allowed in the country. I remember when I remember when they started back in the 30s, and one of the pros, you remember, Walter Hagen, hired a limo and hired a cook and a couple of busboys, and they brought a table and put it in front of the clubhouse, and he had dinner in front of the clubhouse. And then I think that's when they said, you know, we need to let these pros in the clubhouse. But, oh, yeah, Deepdale was like that in Long Island up until, 15 years ago. But that's the way it was. If you go, for instance, here's how you can tell. If you go to the National Long Island, if you notice, the clubhouse is away from the pro shop. You see, the pros, when you go there, you're not allowed in the clubhouse. It's the same thing with Cyprus. If you'll notice, the pro shop is away from the clubhouse. That's old school. And the great thing about it is we've gotten past that. Everything is good now.
Let me mention one other thing that involves you two that I've heard Bruce talk about, and I'll let Bruce maybe start it out and ask you, Lee, what you recall about it. But I seem to remember that Bruce had a lot of luck in final rounds in contention playing with Lee Trevino. And Bruce, you can give us the details.
The Bob Hope.
I don't have to give him any detail. He knows.
I got a great memory, unless I don't want to remember it.
You know? Yeah, there you go. There you go.
We were coming down the stretch and Bruce had enough cotton in his mouth to knit a sweater, and I knew it because we all choke a little bit. We have pressure. We handle it differently. But, you know, we had three holes to go, and he's been leading. So he's playing good. I mean, there's no question that he's playing well. I'm looking at him and the whole thing. Now, you have to understand that golf courses are built in a way to where you never want to go past 180. You got the 360 green. You want to go 180. If you ever get past 180, you got troubles. You can chip the ball up and down from front, right, left. But once you start going past that line, and now you got to chip back this way and that way, it slopes too much, it's downhill. Generally, the green in the back is built up, so it falls down more at the back, and you got to be more creative. So I remember him. I remember the club. I think it was 16, and he pulled out a 7-iron, and I put my hand over my mouth, and it's an 8. It's an 8. And Bruce said, well, it's an 8. So Bruce hits the 8, hits it on the green, 2 putts, ends up winning. But that wasn't the best one. The best one of all was the British Open at Lytham St. Andrews.
1974.
We're playing like a dog. Both of us are playing like a dog. And I've got this old McGregor driver that's got this nickel insert in it. And, I mean, this thing goes about 4 miles, and I can hit it so straight. But I was just spending too much time in the casino. That was my problem. And so we were like dead last. And every time you play in the Open Championship, you always have an official with you. And he goes along with us to give rulings or whatever. So we're on the driving range, and Bruce is missing the driving range. The driving range is 300 yards wide, and he can't hit the range. I mean, it's awful. I mean, I'm watching him hit this driver, and I said, hell, I figure I'm going to look for balls all day. You know, I'm going to be looking for balls all day. So I said, here, hit my driver. See what you can do with mine. And, man, he killed it. He absolutely killed this driver right down the middle of the fairway. And I said, well, man, he said, yeah. He said, that's great. He said, what the hell is that going to do for me? I said, no problem. I said, listen, Bruce, we're going to go out there. I said, let's use the same driver. He said, well, how are you going to do that? I said, well, if I got the honors, I will drive, and the official will be looking down the fairway to see where the ball's going, and you walk right up and take my driver and hand me yours. And we did this for the whole round. Yeah. We only won like $50 anyway. What the hell? We were having a ball. Yeah, but he drove it good. He drove it well.
You've got to add the story about talking to the RNA secretary at a dinner, though, when he would not believe what you just said.
Yeah. Yeah, he wouldn't believe it. I said, well, what? So what? I said, don't pay me. Well, what was it? You couldn't buy steak for what you and I won that day. we had a ball.
We had a ball. That's right.
As you can imagine, having already talked to 41 of your old running mates, we've had some great stories about life on the road back in the day, the things you guys had to endure, because it was certainly different than the days of today.
Hear that? That's the sound of a walk-off albatross, a two on a par five to win a two-day golf tournament. That shot happened to me, one in 600 million odds. Since then, people call me Albie. Now, I've told this story so often, my friends can't take it. I'm pretty sure my wife, next time I tell her, she's going to leave me. So I decided to start a podcast to tell the entire world about it because it deserves it. It's the craziest shot you've never heard of. And guess what? There's tons more stories like this all around golf. And that's what our podcast is all about. Join me and my fellow degenerates, Panda and Shepherd, as we dive into them. Insane bets, crazy what-if scenarios, and all the you-had-to-be-there type moments in golf. Find us wherever you get your podcasts. Did I Tell You About My Albatross?
Oh, I mean, it was unbelievable. I remember playing the Ryder Cup I think with Walton Heath. And we were playing extremely well. And Dave Marr was the captain at the time. And I was going to be first on Sunday out, and I was playing Sam. I had no clue who I actually was playing. So I came down in the hotel lobby to catch a ride, and nobody was there to pick me up to take me to the club so I could eat breakfast. I teed off at 7:30. And it was a pretty good drive. We were staying, you know, downtown. And Sam Torrance comes down the stairs, and he says, they all call me Max. He said, Max, he said, what time are you playing? I said, 7:30. He said, who are you playing? He said, I said, I have no clue. He said, well, you want a ride? I said, I'd love a ride. So he gets in the car and he's taking the rights and the lefts and the rights and the lefts. And I said, Sam, I got to get to the club. I got to tee off at 7:30. He said, don't worry about it. He said, we're going to London. He said, I'm going to get a half a point today. You're playing me. So if we don't show up, we each get a half a point. So anyway, so we went out there and played, and I beat him 7-6. They hadn't even cleaned up the breakfast dishes by the time we got back. You know, we were only out there about an hour. Yeah.
<That's> Sam Torrance. And that was your last Ryder Cup in 1981, as a matter of fact, at Walton Heath, wasn't it?
We had a team there. I'm going to tell you something. Sandy Lyle shot 62 and lost.
Oh
yeah, we had a team that Tom Kite shot 61.
Yeah, boy.
Walton Heath. Yeah, we had a team there. We had a team there. That was the year that that Larry Nelson beat, if I'm not mistaken, beat Sebi every round. Sebi never he couldn't beat Larry Nelson. We beat him in the team. Yeah, Nelson made it like a 40 footer on the last hole to win one up.
Yeah,
Nelson could really play. He was a cool customer. Yeah,
he was.
Yeah, I think his first two Ryder Cups, he was either 7-0 or 9-0 or something like that in his first two Ryder Cups.
Yeah, I could never figure out. I never questioned it, but I've never figured out why he was never a Ryder Cup captain. Yeah, I never could understand that, and I didn't. You know, I didn't say anything to the PGA or anything, but I was wondering. I don't know how they pick them. Yeah.
I don't either.
That's come up a lot from our guests and also from our listeners who have wondered that over the years. So as we always do, Lee, in telling your story, we might as well start at the beginning. And while a lot of this is well known, it's in your book, just take us through those early years growing up in Texas.
Well, I mean, it was a farm. A cotton farm out in Rowlett, Texas, which is about 40 miles outside of Dallas. And then I moved with my granddad in Dallas. My dad, my granddad was, I didn't know my dad, and my granddad raised me. My granddad was a grave digger, to tell you the truth. That's what he was. And I never pursued the game. I didn't know anything about it. But I lived next door to a golf course. I lived next door to DAC, which became Glen Lakes. They played a lot of ladies golf tournaments there. And I used to caddy a little bit at a younger age, which most of us did back in those days. Mm-hmm. That's how we picked it up. Today, it's not that that doesn't happen anymore. But anyway, and I didn't pursue the game. I didn't do anything. I was kind of on my own, raising myself. I've kind of been on my own since I was 8 years old, and so. And I'm amazed, and so is everybody else, that I got to where I'm at from where I came from and how I was raised. And then I dropped out at the age of 14 and just kind of did odd jobs here and there and everywhere. Still not playing any golf or doing anything. And then I got in a little trouble, I guess you could say, with another kid. We were messing around, taking things that didn't belong to us. And Dallas's finest got a hold of me and said, how old are you? I said, 17. And he says, I'm going to be 17. I said, in a month. And he said, I need you to talk to someone. And so he took me to the Marine Corps recruiter. And I ended up going in the Marine Corps, which is the best thing that I ever did. It absolutely settled me down. It gave me some vision. I decided to do the right thing. And I spent 4 years in there, in the Marine Corps. And I still hadn't played much golf. You know, I was here and there as a caddy and out in the parking lots and what have you. And I got out of the Marine Corps in 1960, 61. I went to work on a construction crew building a golf course here in Dallas at the Columbian Club, New Nine Holes. And I started playing a little bit. And I was getting better and better, and I was beating everybody out of their dollars every day. And a guy noticed me at a driving range in a par three course, and he says, you need to go to work for me. He said, I think that you've got some potential. So I went to work for him, and naturally he had a driving range where this is where I toned the driver. And then he had a par three course, and this is where the wedge came from.
Yeah,
We didn't have a putting green. I was never a great putter. Bruce will tell you that when I was on a hot putting streak like I was on 71, I was very difficult to beat because I didn't hit the ball crooked. I didn't hit it crooked. See? Yeah. So I hit the greens. I hit a lot of greens. And if I putted, I was tough to beat. But, you know, I know it's hard to believe, but I really, really didn't start playing golf and got serious about it until I was almost 23.
Yeah.
23 years old. Larry Nelson started when he was 22, got out of the Army.
Yeah.
And the first tournament that I entered after I had practiced 4 years and I'd never played in a tournament, you know, pro-ams, local pro-ams and stuff, but a tournament I never played. And the first one I ever played was at Houston, in Houston was the Texas State Open, and it was at Sharpstown. Yeah. And all the Houston team was there. Homero Blancas. Romero Blancas was there. Fred Marty was there. All the guys that were Toscano was there.
Yeah.
And I ended up winning the tournament in the playoff over a kid from Dallas. Frank Wharton was his name.
Remember him.
And Coach Williams comes up to me after I won and he says, who the hell are you? He said, who the hell are you? I said, I'm nobody. He said, where did you come from? I said, I'm from a little small town outside of Dallas, and I learned to play on a driving range and stuff. The reason that I and Bruce will tell you this, the reason that I was such a good maneuver of the golf ball, you know what I was good at? I was good at flight in the ball. In other words, if I wanted to go 30 feet up, I could go 30 feet up. I could hit it. I could hit five balls the same height. Or I could go higher. I could flight my ball. See, people that can't flight a golf ball, I mean, they
can't control the length. They can't control the length.
That's exactly right. So I could flight it. And the reason for it is because I was a range rat. In other words, in the summertime when it was hot, nobody's coming out to that driving range to hit balls. So what did I do? I took one club and I'd walk around the driving range. And I'd hit all the balls to the middle of the range so they'd be close together where I could pick them up. All different distances. I had to work it around trees, over trees, you know, through fences and the whole thing. And I did it every day. The par three course I used to play with only one club. I didn't use a putter. Then that's when I went to the bottle. You know, I couldn't get a game because I was shooting so low all the time on this par three. So that I came up with the Dr. Pepper bottle, when it was a, and I'd take the neck and I'd hit the ball, with a bottle. And I shot 29, two over par with that bottle one time. Oh, man. I'd take a half a stroke a hole. Any, if you wanted to gamble with me and play against me with the bottle, you know, all I needed was the tie. I said, I'll play you with that bottle and I'll take the tie. And I'd throw the ball up like a baseball bat, boom, and I'd hit the thing like this. I'd throw it up and I'd hit it, and I could hit it 100 yards. I could roll it 100 yards. And the longest hole was 120, and the shortest hole was 55 yards. Well, you know, I made some birdies with it. And then I put the bottle down and putt with the butt, between my legs. I'd putt with it. I could putt pretty. No yips there, baby. One hand. One hand. Yeah.
Well, you know, I've heard you say, and of course read a lot about the fact that you really didn't have instructors or a bunch of lessons, but you had to be influenced by someone somehow. Where did you pick up the various things you needed to do to develop a full game?
Let me tell you something. Up until 1963, when they had the PGA, at DAC, I'd never heard of Jack Nicklaus or Arnold Palmer. This is 1963. I'd never heard of any of those guys. I did meet Dutch Harrison. He came over to the driving range because he knew the owner. I had no clue about professional golf. Nothing. My whole goal was to go out to Tennyson Park and win $5 or $6, $7 a day playing golf. I mean, it was a lot of money back then, and no one could beat me out there. I had a plus six handicap at Tennyson Park, plus six. Now I average 65 around there every day, and when we teamed up and I'd go out there and strangers wanted to play, I'd say, what's your handicap? And they'd say, oh, I'm an eight. You know, they're a four, but they say they're an eight. But then I'd say, I'm a scratch. Well, I was actually a plus six. So I got them by two before we tee off. Yeah. Yeah. I can never remember losing at Tennyson Park. Can't remember doing it. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, Jack won that PGA back at DAC in 63.
I watched him.
Did you get to see him play?
I did. I watched him on the last round because Dave Reagan. That was before they had line of sight. And 17 was a small dog leg left par four. And they had a television tower right on the corner. And Reagan got behind it. And they changed the rule. For some reason, he didn't get line of sight. And he bogeyed the hole. And Nicklaus took, a one-shot lead in par 18 and won the tournament. Yeah.
Hmm. So What did you take away from that experience of seeing Nicklaus for the first time?
Well, I didn't really watch Jack. I was kind of walking around, watching different people hit shots. To tell you the truth, I will tell you this. I didn't even think about this is what I want to do. You know what I'm saying? I didn't even think about it. I fell into that after I'd won that tournament in 65. Then people were saying, you could probably, get on tour. And how I got on there is when I finished fifth at Balderstraw in 67, I qualified. And when I finished fifth at Balderstraw, I got some invitations to play in the tournament, which I didn't know. The first invitation actually was the Western Open. I think it was at Beverly at the time. And then that'd the next right. one they get, yeah. And then they sent me one to play Carling, I think it was, in Canada.
World Open?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, the World Open. I got there. Yeah. And then they invited me to play in Westchester. So all of a sudden, I got three invitations. So I went to, this is a funny story. I went, so I took my wife and my daughter, and I put them in the 65 Plymouth station wagon. And we decided to drive to Minnesota to qualify on Monday to be a rabbit to see if I could get a little tune-up before I went to the Western Open. So we drove all the way playing Hazeltine.
Yeah.
And we were qualifying on Monday. And I shot 77 or 78. You can look it up if I'm not mistaken. And all the cars were parked right in front of the clubhouse in the field there. And Wade Cagle. I was packing all my car up because I shot 78, I think it was. I figured there's no way that I'm going to make this tournament. I did not know that they had 62 spots. And I'm packing my car. And back in those days, you could call anybody or whatever you wanted to. My nickname was Pinto Bean. Hey, Pinto Bean. Everybody called me Pinto Bean. So Wade Cagle comes by. He says, hey, Pinto Bean. He says, where are you going? I said, wait. I shot 78. I said, hell, I'm going to Chicago. He said, what are you talking about? He said, we got 62 spots here. I said, I shot 78. He said, hell, you're leading. That's how hard Hazel
Well, it was hard.
We had never seen anything like that, Bruce. We'd never seen a course like that. We'd been playing these Donald Ross courses and Tillinghast courses and stuff, which are short and open and facing you and bunkers to the right, you know, and to the left, no fairway bunkers. All of a sudden, we show up at this course where the rough was a foot high. Dave Hill, what did Dave Hill tell him? They ruined a great farm. He said they ruined a great farm here. But I mean, that course was really difficult, really difficult. And we had never seen anything like it. And I've never seen anything like it since, except PGA West. PGA West, in my opinion, if you get on that back tee at PGA West, it's all you want. It's really a difficult course. So I ended up going to all these tournaments. I was a PGA member, Class A. If you were a PGA member, you could participate or qualify for these tournaments. And if you made the cut on Friday, you were automatically in the next tournament. So I went up and I started going, and I wasn't missing any cuts. So I just kept going and ended up playing 13 tournaments. And to qualify for Rookie of the Year, you have to play 16. But since I made 13 cuts in a row and played 13 tournaments, I won $33,000 for the year. And Hawaii was the last one. And I ended up getting Rookie of the Year with 13 tournaments. They gave it to me because no one was even close to me in scoring and everything. So,
yeah.
But, you know, but that's what one of the things that I'm proud of more than anything. I know I won the majors and do all this stuff, but the scoring average has got a lot to do with that's where you're at. That's how you get into Hall of Fames and stuff. You got to win majors. But you got to look at a guy's scoring average. And I won that thing five times. Yeah, yep. I won it five times. But I wouldn't have won it all five times if Nicklaus would have played enough rounds. A couple of times Nicklaus actually was lower than I. But I think you had to play 18 tournaments maybe to qualify for the Borden Trophy, which was low scoring. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think you had to qualify for that. You had to play 18 tournaments. Nicklaus only played 16. But his score is actually lower than mine. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I could spend Bruce probably the next 30 minutes just recounting Lee's record and accomplishments on tour. But some of the highlights for our listeners, 92 professional wins, including 29 PGA Tour victories. That ties him for 17th on the all-time list. And oh, by the way, 13 of those guys are older than Lee, so they played many in a different era.
Right, that's right.
And also to get a match set, 29 victories also on the senior tour, and he's third there behind Hale Irwin, who we've talked to with 45 wins, Bernhard Langer, who we just talked to with 43 wins. So quite a record, 6 majors, as we've alluded to, Jack being the recipient of being second in 4 of those. And I'm sure at some point we'll get to talk about each of those major championship winners. As Lee mentioned, 5-time Varden Trophy winner. He's PGA Player of the Year in 71, which was an outstanding year.
Oh,
won a lot of other things. Moneyless, Byron Nelson. He won a tournament every year from 68 to 81, which is an incredible stretch of consistent golf. So a whole lot of stuff to talk about, Lee, but if we get back to the U.S. Open, because I think those first 3 for you were quite important. I mean, they're just different milestones. You qualified for your first one at Olympic Club in 66 in Odessa, Texas, and made $600 making the cut, didn't you?
Yeah, I made the cut. I finished 54th, I think, in that tournament or something like that. And I'd never seen rough like that. You know, I'm used to playing a public golf course where they mow the golf course with one more. You know, I mean, they don't have six mowers to mow at different heights. You know, oh, this is the first cut. Oh, this is the second cut, and this is No, you play tennis in Park East. They got one mower. It's probably five gangs. They're going around trees. They mow it once a week, and that's it. Well, I got the Olympic, and man, I looked at that fescue or whatever they had there, man, and I couldn't get out of it because I'm flat. I stood away from the wall a long way, as Bruce can tell you. I didn't stand away from it. I'm 5'7", and I'm a flat swinger. And I was laying the sod right over it. But what carried me there was the driver. Naturally, I was the only hole I had a difficult time hitting was 17. That hole that went up the hill and dogleg left, because it sloped so much from left to right that I'd hit a cut up there and it would run down in the rough every time, run down. But 18, no problem. I'd drive it down the bottom, you know, put it on the green. But I was there. I felt so bad for Arnold Palmer. You know, that's when Arnold Palmer had a 7-shot lead with 9 holes to go, and he lost. He made cash for time. I didn't play. You know, it was my first one. I didn't know if I wanted to go back and play a U.S. Open because of the difficulty. And my ex-wife says to me, she says, you got to try it one more time. She said, it was $20. And I mean, so we sent the $20 to go back. And that's when I qualified for DAC, I think it was. Dallas Athletic Club. Yeah, I made Eagle on 13 or something to make it. I think I had the fourth spot there. We had four spots. I think I got the fourth spot. And we went to Balderstraw. Yeah, that's the first time I'd seen Jack Nicklaus was at Balderstraw. And if you've ever been to Balderstraw, the pro shop's up high, and there's a suspension bridge that goes from the pro shop to the parking lot, and the putting green is down below, maybe 20 feet down below you. It's kind of in this little dungeon down there. And as I'm walking, I had the Cadillac agency guy there. Wanted me to have a beer with him. So I went up and sat at the patio, and he says, would you like a beer? I said, I love beer. So I drank the beer, and you know me, you've been from Texas. It didn't take long to drink a beer. And so I put it down. He said, would you like another one? The next thing you know, I drink. He says, well, I'll buy them. You just drink them. I said, okay. So after about 8, he says, damn, I never seen anybody drink this much beer. I said, this is nothing. I said, we do this. It's hot down there. We don't drink water. I said, we just drink this stuff. So anyway, so I'm leaving. It's already dark. So I'm leaving to go out to get the car and to go to the hotel. And I'm walking over the suspension bridge, and I see this little white object moving in the dark back and forth. And I can't tell who it is. And I said, somebody came along, and I said, who is that? He said, that's Nicklaus. I said, Mr. Nicklaus? He said, yeah. He said, he's practicing his putting stroke. I said, you got to be joking. He said, yeah. Come to find out, it was a white bullseye that Dean Beeman had given him that week there, because Jack wasn't putting good with his Wizard 600. Uh-huh. So Beeman says, you need to try this bullseye. And Beeman gave him that white bullseye. He had painted it white. And that's the one Nicklaus won that tournament with. Yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yes, sir. I could have done better there. I got nervous. I finished 5th. And I'll tell you why I got nervous is I didn't know the rules that well. And do you remember they had continuous putting?
Yes.
And a couple of times I got scared about marking my ball. So I reached over to try to make a couple of 2-footers. And I missed them both. Yeah. Yeah. Not I was playing good. With January. I'd never seen anybody get out of the rough like January, because he stands so tall over the ball. He's not flat. And I played with Dave Hill, I think it was, in January. I putted with a bullseye, heavy blade, offset. And I broke it. And you're not going to believe this. And I broke it trying to bend it, because those bullseyes would break easy. And for 50 years, I've been looking for another one. I've never found one.
Wow.
I'll be dying.
I've never found one. I tell you, I look in the eBay. I look everywhere. I ask people, and I've never found another one. Yeah. They tried to make me one. They tried to make me one, but it didn't. Yeah, it wasn't the same. It was an offset. It's called an offset heavy blade.
I don't think I've ever seen one.
Yeah, it's a bullseye. I know a guy that had one, but he won a tournament with it. He won't. Gibby Gilbert has one.
Does he really?
Yeah, I wouldn't putt with it anyway. I mean, these things they're making today are self-shooters anyway, you know. Yeah. If your nerve is good, you know. I mean, case in point, look at the scores on the PGA Tour. You know, everybody says, oh, but they drive it so far. Baloney, look how they putt.
Yeah.
And that's a lot to do with the equipment, the balance of the putter, the shafts. You know, the way they figured it out. Science is real. I mean, it's real. I mean, there's a lot of good stuff out there today. A lot of good stuff.
Of course, the green conditions are a little bit better than what you guys played on too.
Well, we used to putt on the tees. In other words, if you basically go and play a golf course and tee the ball up on the tee, that's what Bruce and I putted on.
Yeah.
And that's why that heavy blade, we had to have a heavy putter.
Yeah.
We couldn't putt with a light putter. Yeah, it had to be heavy. Yeah, a lot of mallets back then. Heavy mallets. Yeah,
heavy mallets. Yeah. That's what I use. Yeah. A heavy mallet.
Yeah, had to be.
That's why 2-footers weren't gimmies, were they?
Oh no, I missed a 9-incher on Korai in Japan one time, and I lined up. I marked it, put it down, and I didn't touch the hole. And I think I was like 9 inches. I said, holy moly. You know, that core right, that thing, you had to be careful when you teed your ball up, it cut your finger. I'm telling you, that grass. was tough.
Maybe that's why Captain Sam Snead thought Tony Jacklin should have putted that putt in the Ryder Cup that Nicklaus gave him.
Yeah.
Oh, I thought that was a pretty good gesture. I think that'll go down in history, sportsmanship. This game's about, you know, this is when we get along so well. I mean, come on. I mean, I don't know about Bruce, but I played out there, 20 years and stuff? I broke up. A couple of guys were going to get into it in the locker room one time, and I got in between them and told them, I said, listen, guys, where are you going with it? Are you going to kill each other or what? Because if you're not going to kill this guy, then why the hell hit him? You know, because he might get mad and kill you. You better leave it alone. And we never had any problems.
It was at this moment in the interview that Bruce's wife, Gloria Devlin, entered Bruce's studio to say hello to good friend Lee Trevino. Well, look who we got here.
Hey! How are you, honey? You look fabulous. How are you? Good to I tell you what, you're taking good care of that old dog right there. I can tell that.
Bruce, you got to relay dog. What Lee's saying to her because she can't hear you.
Oh, yeah. It's good to see you.
I'll tell her. I'll tell her. She wanted to come in and say hi to you. So.
That's great. Thank you. Thank you.
She always tells the story about flying from Australia to Los Angeles with Lee Trevino when she had our youngest boy, Kurt, who was, he was 3 or 4 years old or something, and he slept all the way, and Lee kept saying to Gloria, hey, Gloria, I think that boy's dead. I mean, how can he? He's not even moving. What's going on with him?
He never moved. I mean, that's about a 15-hour flight. Oh, my God. How about Gary? Gary Player would get on a plane, he'd go to the front and sleep on the floor.
Yeah,
and
amazing.
And then when they stopped, we stopped in the Canary Islands one time to refuel, and he got off the plane and ran up. He was running up and down
getting his exercise.
The landing strip. Yeah, he was getting exercise. He was running up and down the I tell you what, He did it right, though, because I just saw him last week, and he looks fabulous. He's 86 years old.
He does look great. Yeah.
He looks great. He can hit it, too. He can still move that ball out there at 86.
Yeah, that's great. He loves to play. He loves to play.
He plays every day.
Yeah.
I like it, too, but, I don't play much anymore. It doesn't do a lot for me. If some friends come in town or something, I'll go out and play 9 holes or something. I play with the dog. The dog and I play.
Dog all the time. You played with the dog. You played with the dog yesterday. I know that because he sent me a little text last night, and he said, Oh, I see where Lee's going to do the podcast with you tomorrow. So you must have filled him in.
Yeah, I filled him in. I actually were playing with I was playing with Lee Michaels and Cameron Doan, the pro out there, and Ishenbrenner, my sponsor, came in from El Paso, and we played a quick 18. Yeah. But I see the dog every day. He looks good.
He does.
Yeah.
So do you know how he got his name, Dog?
No, I have the putter. I still have a putter with Dog on it.
Okay.
But I thought that was his initials, but it's not because his middle name is not
Anthony.
D-A-G.
Yeah, it's Anthony David Graham, I think.
So when we were on a flight going from Sydney to Adelaide with a guy by the name of Alan Murray, who you may have met, who came over here and played on the tour a little bit. And David arrived with a beautiful, typical David Graham, dressed to the hilt, nothing out of place, had this new leather duffel bag with him, right? And he gets up during the flight and goes to the bathroom, and Alan Murray pulls that bag out, and it's got D-A-G on it. So he takes a big marking pen, and he went right over the A and turned it into an O. He said, "That's what your name is. You're a dog," and it stuck.
It stuck
forever.
He gave me a putter that I guess Scotty Cameron made for him. He's got more golf clubs than Arnold Palmer. I don't know where the hell he puts them. He pull hooks everything because naturally he can't turn like he used to.
Yeah.
So I play with him. I play with him a lot. We play nine holes. We hit practice balls almost every time I go out. We get together. But he's got drivers. He keeps thinking it's the driver. I told him, I said, it's the Indian, it's not the arrow.
The tinkerer of all tinkerers with golf clubs, David Graham.
He knows his clubs. He knows his clubs. He can really do some stuff with them, very meticulous about what he does, I'm like Arnold Palmer when it comes to clubs, I grind them. I don't think about polishing them. As long as the grooves are not messed with, I don't care what the back looks like.
Yeah.
He's not like that. No.
Thank you for listening to another episode of For the Good of the Game. And please, wherever you listen to your podcast on Apple and Spotify, if you like what you hear, please subscribe, spread the word, and tell your friends. Until we tee it up again, for the good of the game, so long, everybody.
Whack down the fairway. It went smack down the fairway. Then it started to slice just a smidge off line. It headed for two, but it bounced off nine. My caddy says, long as you're still in the state, you're okay. Yes, it went straight down the middle, quite a way.